This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and it's time for our weekly recap. Carrie Junior II is here. He's the show's producer.
Was it? I couldn't think of like a
The Price is Right theme. Is that what you're thinking?
That is what that sounded like.
I used to love that show. Yeah. Weekly recap.
Weekly recap.
Come on down.
$1. $1, Stephen.
So this week we have a themed weekly recap because we had kind of a themed week of shows. Many of the things we talked about this week had to do with indigenous people here in the United States and the various ways in which American life challenges them with unfairness and inequality. It was a really interesting collection of conversations, I think, and it got pretty deeply into the ways in which I think we don't recognize or even notice the things about American life that have had an impact on the people who were here before America was here and a negative impact.
Yeah. Yeah. A nice tied week of shows about indigenous peoples that we'll be revisiting. And so to recap it real quick, we've got three kind of overlapping shows, more overlapping than I initially suspected. We will be revisiting a conversation about the land we live on currently and how it was acquired. We talk about the treaties between European settlers and Native Americans and how they were unfair. We had another conversation this week about land-grant institutions, which are schools that were founded with acres of land, and they use that land to develop the schools, and about how those land-grant institutions now, the major state schools, still to this day profit from that land. And we'll be revisiting a conversation about the repatriation of Native American remains and artifacts. I think we're going to start with that episode. So in 1990, the Native American Graves and Protection Act was enacted, and it required museums that had Native American remains and items and artifacts, it required them to return those items back to Native American tribes. In December of last year, that law was updated to include more specific processes for how to return those items and remains, included input from Native Americans themselves. This year, museums across the country have been putting in more effort to return those items. And so what we wanted to talk about is how that process happens. And so Chip Colwell was our guest who we spoke to who could speak really specifically to this issue. Chip Colwell is an anthropologist and a former senior curator of anthropology at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, where he, in firsthand, returned a number of items from their museum to Native American tribes. So he does a really good job of talking about not only the process, but how his background in his field of anthropology has this like long-standing
conflict.
Has changed
and is evolving around this whole question. Their sense of it now is far more conciliatory to the idea that these were wrongs that were committed and they have got to find a way to fix them. I want to start this section of the conversation talking about your experience. You arrive at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science in 2007. Tell me about the state of its collection of indigenous items at that point, and I guess what reaction you had to the state of that collection.
I arrived in 2007 at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science pretty naive to the realities of what it would take to actually do this work in repatriation, the return of ancestral human remains and their belongings to tribes. I had at that point gone through myself a series of crises to determine I wanted to do this work. I grew up in Tucson, Arizona, loved history, had amazing teachers that got me really into Native American culture. I started going out on archaeology digs in my teens. I set up a lab. My chemistry teacher helped me set up a lab to study animal bones in high school still. you know, I loved it. And I didn't realize until later, in a very harsh way, how what I saw as my love of Native history, Native peoples themselves saw as a form of appropriation and theft and harm. And so when I came to this understanding, I really struggled with how I could continue in this work. And eventually what I realized was perhaps I could do best by trying to be a bridge between those who do love Native history and culture and want to help and protect it and understand it, and Native cultures that see it as a form of violation. Hmm. So I came to the job in 2007 hoping to be that bridge or be a part of that movement of bridging those worlds. And the museum in Denver at that point was out of compliance with a federal law that affects repatriation, mm-hmm. that puts repatriation in place, return of these items and ancestors to tribes. And so it was kind of you're thrown into the fire, you know, and you just have to start somewhere. And luckily, I had an amazing set of colleagues at the museum all the way up and down the institution that were really committed to getting us right and getting us not only in line with the law, but also to embrace the spirit of it, to understand that this wasn't just a rote bureaucratic responsibility, mm-hmm. but this was a form of justice, that we could actually try to repair past wrongs by doing things right today. Yeah. So we worked really hard, and within about a year, we were able to get the museum back in compliance with the law. And then we really turned to, okay, now that we're doing the bare minimum, what can we do to actually take the responsibility of history on our shoulders and try to set it right?
And eventually, you come to a rather certain conclusion about what's going on. I mean, so certain that the title of the book that you published in 2017 is Plundered Skulls and Stolen Spirits. I mean, that's such a powerful, mm-hmm. such a powerful mm-hmm. phrase. There's no ambiguity there about mm-hmm. about how you feel about what was right. what was done. Talk about that journey from 2007 to 2017.
Yes. You know, I think it's when you really get into each particular case. So the way it works is museums inventory their collections, they notify tribes of what they have, and then tribes have the ability to claim those items from the museum. And then the museum decides if those claims are valid and then to return the items or not. So this is the framework under this 1990 federal law that all museums that receive federal funding are subject to. And when you get, so you need to look at every individual case. And some of these cases are so unsettling, horrifying even, that you begin to understand what Native communities have suffered so horribly for decades. Mm. So this, in one part of the book, I talk about a scalp, a part of someone's head that was stolen from an Arapaho chief during a massacre in 1864 in eastern Colorado called the Sand Creek Massacre. And this was just a terrifying event in which the U.S. Army murdered hundreds of Arapaho and Cheyenne people. And they then took body parts from the victims and paraded them through Denver. And then these items, these body parts, ended up in museum collections and people's personal collections, and many more just disappeared. We never we never learned the fate of them. Mm-hmm. But one of those scalps ended up at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science. And there simply is no humane explanation for why this happened or why a museum would continue to hold a human scalp taken sure. from a murder victim. In another case that I talk about in the book, there are religious items that belong to the Zuni people. So it's a tribe, a Pueblo tribe in northwestern New Mexico. Mm-hmm. These are wooden sculptures that they call Ahayuda, or often it's translated as war gods or keepers of the sky in English. And these are placed at shrines around the periphery of the traditional lands to protect the people. And from the Zuni perspective, these aren't wood sculptures or pieces of art. They are literally living gods. They breathe life into these beings so that they can serve the people. And these lived at unprotected shrines all around the Pueblo. Mm-hmm. And you read the cases and it's just one after one, they're being plucked away, just stolen. And it became, they're unprotected. White people come in, think they're fascinating, and just take them. They just take them. And at one point, Zunis were starving because of different federal policies. They literally didn't have enough to eat. And a collector from the Brooklyn Museum comes in and convinces people to just turn over all of their religious items, and he's going to give them money so that they can eat. So he uses this just crisis, a famine, to manipulate Zunis into stealing their own history and selling it just so they can survive. So when you learn about these kinds of cases, for me, that's the foundation. That's the starting point to understand how violated Native peoples have been over the decades and the ways in which we in the museum world, society at large, needs to come to terms with this history, recognize it, to acknowledge what we've done to Native communities so that we can try to set things right.
Yeah. So there's a passage in the introduction to the book where you talk about the way that you saw things when you were younger and got to the Denver Museum. You say, for me, bones are no different from shards of pottery to be pieced back together into beautiful vases. Is that a kind of writ large way of thinking of the way that these museums approached these items, that they were just science or art?
Very much so. I mean, that is the secular, scientific with a capital S, profane way of seeing these things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to me, one of the most fascinating and troubling cases that I talk about in the book is precisely the ways in which human bones, human remains, can be either seen as merely, you know, pieces of a scientific puzzle that we can put together, because you can learn amazing things from human remains. You can learn about what people ate, where they lived, their ancestry. You can look at diseases. You can look at wear and tear on the bones to understand what kind of activities they participated in. Our bodies are maps of our histories and identities. Mm. And the science can use those to understand who people were and the larger human story. And that's not to be discounted. But what's to say is that not everyone shares that view. When it's your ancestor, when it's your grandmother or your great-great-great-grandfather, you have something different at stake. And so these are two different worldviews that clash in fundamental ways when it comes to the questions of collection and return and what should happen. So what that passage in the book was pointing to was that culture clash and the ways in which this isn't merely a legal question, this isn't merely a historical question, this is a question of how different people see the world so differently. You know, is this an ancestor or is this a scientific tool?
Right.
Is this a piece of wood or is this a living god? You know, it's precisely that knot that we untangle in the work of repatriation.
Yeah. And here, one of the challenges clearly is that it was easy in some ways to dismiss the humanity of these items because as a nation, we dismiss the humanity of these people. I mean, you couldn't do this, I wouldn't imagine, with Irish immigrants or with the remains of German settlers or, you know, anything like that. I mean, there would be a natural pushback to that I feel that, like, would be was absent here.
That's precisely the case. And what's important to understand is the ways in which the United States and other nations codified the objectification of Native peoples. And in the book, I tell the story of how Iowa became one of the first states to protect Native Americans, not only in life, but in death. And in brief, the story is a new highway was being constructed. Archaeologists are called out. They find several dozen graves. The archaeologists determine that all of the graves belong to white settlers, except for one Native woman. And all of the white graves are excavated because they're going to be destroyed by the highway, and they're immediately reburied, immediately taken to a new cemetery and buried because the archaeologists say they're white. The one Native woman, only because she's Native, her remains are boxed up and taken to the state museum. And so here you have one place, all these people live together. They're actually all part of the same community, all from the 1800s. And the one woman was treated differently only because archaeologists said she was Native. And so she becomes a museum object, and all of the white people go back into a grave for eternal rest. So when a Native woman, she was actually not even an activist, she was just, her husband was working on the highway project, learned of this. Her name was Maria Pearson. She single-handedly went to the governor of Iowa and convinced him about the wrongness of this law under Iowa that made Native peoples archaeological objects.
Wow.
And she and the governor, over the course of a number of years, became, you know, created a law that actually protected Native peoples and their remains and their belongings. And so Iowa became the first state to give equal protections to Native peoples in life and in death.
Yeah, yeah. That was our conversation with Chip Colwell about museums and the need for American museums to identify things that were taken from Native tribes and to return them to those tribes. The conversation aired on August 19th. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to hear a conversation about the history of land-grant institutions, universities here in the United States, and their connection to wrongs done to indigenous people. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. We are back with more Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and Carrie Jr. II, our producer, is here in the studio with me. We're talking this week about, we're listening this week to conversations about unfairnesses and inequalities that challenge indigenous people here in the United States. Up next, Carrie, we're going to hear a conversation about our institutions of higher ed, some of the largest institutions of higher ed in our country, and the connection that they have to wrongs that were done to Native Americans.
Yeah, I mean, I think land-grant institutions, institutions that were founded based off of the Morrill Act of 1862. And so at that time, the federal government decided they wanted to start these higher education institutions and did that by giving each state, pretty much committing each state to acres of land that was previously taken away from Native people. In this conversation, we sit down with Tristan Ottone. He is the editor at large of GRIST, which is a nonprofit media organization. And they released an investigative report looking into 14 land-grant institutions that specifically continue to profit from that land. So not only did they receive the land from the federal government, profit from it initially to build the schools up, but they still continue to use that land for profit today.
Yeah.
I also want to note, too, that there are also other land-grant institutions. There's HBCUs were designated as land-grant institutions in about 1890, and then tribal colleges, which are tribally founded and run colleges and institutions, were designated land-grant institutions in 1994, but neither one of those categories of schools received land when they were designated as a land-grant institution. They instead receive an endowment or money. So Tristan Lee breaks down the history of these land-grant institutions, where they got their land from, how they profited from it, and how much money these institutions made.
how universities make or raise money from this land. So the land gets taken from these native tribes. It is given to the universities explicitly for them to make money off of so that they can build and become successful. What does that look like? Is it just sale of the land, or are there other things involved?
Well, it's mostly sale of those original lands, and especially for universities that are on the East Coast. So there are some private universities, for instance, like Cornell or MIT, that were also land-grant institutions and given land. But, East Coast, there's this sort of bifurcation of East Coast and West Coast universities. Universities on the East Coast more or less didn't have any public lands inside their borders anymore to give to universities. So they were given sort of coupons called scrip for newly acquired lands in the West as the nation expanded westward. And then the Western universities, which are given land within more or less their borders or territorial borders. Again, most universities sold their lands pretty quickly. In order to sort of bring in, quick cash for their endowments. But there were, what we found, at least in our initial reporting from 2020, was there were another 16 universities that held on to a large number of their Morrill Act lands. And a lot of them are used for generating revenue, grazing, some commercial leasing, a lot of oil and gas. More or less, these universities figured out that if they could hold on to them for a longer period of time, there were ways to capitalize even larger. So, there are some institutions that are still profiting off of those initial lands that were given to them in the 1800s. So that's one act that's benefited them, and they continue to make money off of. Additional acts have granted lands to those universities also.
And let's talk about oil and gas, mining, fossil fuels, the tie-in here to that kind of development and the money for these universities.
Yeah, so pause for a second here to say that these initial 52 universities become universities through the Morrill Act, through the Land Grant Act. Mm-hmm. There is and many of them still hold those lands from the 1800s that were given to them. What reporting we've been doing recently really focuses on something called enabling acts. So, when there's a territory is going to become a state, that state needs to pass an enabling act so it can enter the union, right? So through enabling acts, most states that pass enabling acts also have language in them for the federal government to provide them land for their public institution. So you've got the Morrill Act lands that are coming in. And then when you become a state, the Enabling Act gives you even more land on top of that. And our recent investigations have really been looking at lands that come through those Enabling Acts. Same concept. It's land taken from indigenous peoples that are then used for these different public institutions. And we were looking at states in which enabling acts provided lands to these land-grant universities as well. We found there were 14 land-grant institutions which generate revenue from about 8.2 million surface and mineral acres. Most of that, about 25% of that land is designated for either fossil fuel production or the mining of minerals like coal or taconite. Mm-hmm. So these are lands that we're really beginning to track now and sort of expand on a little bit more in terms of thinking about all the ways in which these institutions continue to profit off indigenous land and resources. And this is one other act which focuses on land that enriches these institutions.
So in modern terms, what do the universities say about this money, about this process, about this history, that their very beginnings, their very existence from the start depends on having had someone take this land from Native peoples and give it to them and allow them to sell it or, as you point out, to make money off of it in ways that that you know no one probably could have imagined.
Well, yeah, it's a good question. Many institutions acknowledge this history. Others flat out ignore it. You know, we've seen a lot of institutions, for instance, like Washington State University, rewrote its land acknowledgement, you know, about how the institution got started. It also pledged to commission a team to determine reconciliation plans. Texas A&M is kind of working toward assembling a task force also to sort of better understand the history of the Morrill Act and its impact on the institution and tribes. You know, we've seen like a lot of teach-ins at institutions like Cornell, for instance, which was the largest Morrill Act beneficiary, and staff and faculty have launched a project to document the university's financial windfall. Mm-hmm. You know, we've seen like there are a lot of places that are actually beginning to lean into this history pretty heavily and taking steps, maybe slow steps, but still steps to sort of understanding what this history means for them and what their role and in some cases even what how they can address this history. As I said, a lot of other institutions have completely ignored it. A lot of states, schools in the South, for instance, have almost completely ignored everything from requests for comment to any of the historical sort of analysis that's going on. You know, it really just depends on the institution, but I would say some are grappling with it okay, but none of them are really grappling with it in a way that I think Indigenous staff and faculty would like to see them do.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it seems like maybe it's just kind of forgotten in a reparative sense. Let's talk about the presence, though, of Native peoples at these universities, students, faculty. I am a graduate of the University of Michigan, but I spend a lot of time at Michigan State because I've got a student that is belongs to me who was enrolled there. When I go to these places, and of course, the University of Michigan was not a land grant university, but Michigan State was, I don't see a formidable presence of Native of peoples, which would be perhaps one way that you might think of trying to repair the damage that was done by this. But is that happening? Is that being done with intention to try to make up for all of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been a lot of calls for like free tuition at these institutions. That's not really happening a whole lot. I mean, presence, I think, is we can get back to that. But presence is really a big thing. I mean, Michigan State, for instance, when we collected data on Michigan State, I think there were 50,000 students in 2018. Mm-hmm. Only 104 of them were Native American or Alaska Native. Wow. You know, this is not unusual. Usually it's a pretty small number of Native students that are at these institutions. And yeah, I think there are many, many ways in which scholars and academics and folks that work in these systems have thought about what reparations can look like. And, you know, free tuition is basically the easiest thing that you can do. I mean, 104 students is not going to break the bank.
Right.
You know, so these are some of the things to sort of like look at. But generally, there aren't a ton of Native students at these institutions. And usually the barrier for entry is just the massive amount of money that it takes to go to college.
It's expensive, sure.
Yeah, very.
What about trying to tie current profits from this land to reparative efforts? I mean, you point out that a lot of these schools are still making money off of what they were initially given. They didn't just sell the land. They've found ways to monetize it. Is there ever a discussion about whether you could help fix, well, you know, the taking aspect of this by trying to reimburse tribes in some way? Not that you ever could, but in other contexts, I guess, is part of what I'm getting at. This is how we think of reparative work. This is how we think of how we fix things that were done wrong in the past. Is that discussion surfaced here at all?
I mean, I guess I can't say that it really has. I think, again, these institutions are big and they move slowly, but and we see a lot of action that's happening from students, staff, and faculty. But from an administration level, I can't say that there's a ton of conversation that we're seeing around this. I think that if that is going to happen in the future, it's going to be because of students, staff, and faculty that are holding their institutions accountable. But you know, what reparations, what restitution, what reparative justice actually looks like, I think it's different from university to university. And I think that's something that universities really have to figure out on their own on some level. I think I think part of the conversation is that they could be reaching out to indigenous nations that were impacted by their actions and activities to start working on what those plans could look like. But, you know, it's really hard to make a plan for like how you make things right if you're not talking to the people that you wronged.
That you wronged, right. What about the tribes that had this land taken? I mean, of course, the native population in in this country is not what it used to be, but how much presence is there in these states of tribes to even raise their hands and say, hey, you know, this was done and it wasn't right and we'd like to make it right?
Well, I mean, I think there's a law. I mean, I don't remember how many tribal nations are in Michigan off the top of my head here, mm-hmm. but most states in the West have, impacted tribal nations that are within their borders.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think this is one of the things that universities need to keep in mind is that it's not on the tribes to come to the university to say, hey, you did us wrong, like you need to fix it. It's up to the universities, right?
To say,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Stephen, if I come to your house and I, you know, like drive over your front lawn or something like that, it's not up to you to come to me and tell me that you messed it up, that I messed it up, right? Like I need to come back and say, look, I'm really sorry I did that. You know, and that, I think that's really how, I know it sounds a little oversimplistic to say that that's how apologies work, but it's how apologies work. That's how you build a better future, is that you're talking to the people that you have harmed, and making sure that you're thinking of a future together. And until those conversations happen, there is no future together.
So when I think of higher ed and I think of reparative work, I mean, you have universities doing some pretty extraordinary things, trying to document things that they've done to people in the past, trying to come up with ways to fix it. I'm thinking specifically of Georgetown University, which got called out for slave sales that the priests there engaged in early on. A very similar kind of story in order to help the university survive. Their response to that was to come up with ways to help the families of those slaves now and those former slaves now and try to make it right. Lots of universities, of course, have DEI programs these days, and some of them are under fire. But at most universities, they're at least gesturing in a way that says we want to get this right. I guess I wonder why this isn't happening for Native peoples. What is it about this that doesn't rise to the level of these other wrongs that they seem perfectly willing to at least contemplate? And I don't think anyone would say they're getting it 100% right, but there is an effort and there's certainly an acknowledgement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to, the reparative efforts for slavery at institutions. That's, that was a big inspiration for our reporting and project in terms of looking at how these institutions have begun to engage with that history.
Uh-huh.
But what I guess what I can say is that I do think that there is one big difference here is that when it comes to reparative efforts for this history, I think what we're actually talking about here is really upending almost the entire history of the United States. And on some level, I think we're talking about upending property law in the U.S. I mean, you know, this idea that, like, you know, one day you come and steal my bicycle, and every day I have to see you riding my bicycle by, and I'm like, hey, man, I really like my bicycle.
I'd like that back.
And you're like, look, I'll put a plaque on it and say that this used to be your bicycle. I'm like, okay, I mean, I guess that's fine, but I'd still like the bicycle back. You know, like, you're still on the bicycle no matter what.
Right.
And no matter how many plaques you put on it, or how many, if you ride by me and you say, I recognize that this was your bicycle, like, basically, like, I still want the bicycle back. And I do think that that is one of the biggest conversations that's been happening for the last 10 years here, is this idea of land back. And what does that actually mean? What does that mean for states? What does that mean for universities, for churches, for any institution that is more or less engaged in this behavior in the past? Like, there's really, I think, only one really true reparative justice here when it comes to stolen land and resources. And that's a conversation that absolutely nobody wants to have.
Because of the difficulty of figuring that out, or the moral difficulty of confronting it?
I mean, moral difficulty, I actually don't think it's all that hard to figure out, honestly. But, you know, I mean, I think, I mean, this is a conversation about power. You know, like, is the state of Michigan willing to give up, like, hundreds of thousands of acres of land to make something right?
Right.
Like, that's a conversation about power, not justice.
Yeah. That was a conversation with journalist Tristan Ottone about the history of land-grant universities here in the United States and their connection to land that was stolen from indigenous people. That conversation aired on August 20th. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about history right here in the state of Michigan. Where does all the land come from that makes up state of Michigan? How did we acquire that land? We'll be right back with more Created Equal. This is Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson in the studio with Carey Jr. II. It is our weekly recap show. This week, taking a listen back to conversations that we had about the challenges faced by indigenous people in this country, based on some of the things that that we have done to them to build America. Up next, Carey, we're going to talk about the state of Michigan and where all the land that that makes up the state of Michigan actually came from, whose land it was before, and some of the pretty nefarious tactics that were used to convince Native people, or force Native people in many cases, to give up that land so that Michigan could exist.
Yeah, I mean, we started this recap kind of looking at other states and kind of national perspective of how our history and our experiences bump up against indigenous people's history. And I think this is a closer look at our state. And this is an experience that I believe is widespread. This happened across the country, but it was nice for us to at least localize it and understand how the land that we live on came to be and where it came from. And so we speak to an author. He's author and journalist, Robert Downs. He wrote this book entitled Raw Deals, The Indians of the Midwest and the Theft of Native Lands. We sat down with him and discussed pretty much the history here.
Yeah, it's an interesting conversation in the sense that it brings this whole theme really close to our sensibilities here in places like Detroit. When we think about the names even of cities,
right,
in Michigan and counties, so many of them are
roads.
There, so many of them are drawn from Native languages and from Native peoples. And we don't often stop to pause to think, how did that happen? Or maybe we always think, well, that happened because we bought those things from Native people, or they were part of trying to create Michigan. this is a much darker side of those stories.
You know, I was thinking you were going to say the inverse. I thought you were talking about the roads and the buildings named after the settlers.
Who, well, that's the other thing we have, right?
That we talk about too, right?
People who did some of these awful things also have been celebrated by our culture. Bob, I want to start this segment talking about a figure in our history who is more familiar, I guess, than the history of Indigenous Americans to most of us in Southeast Michigan. General Anthony Wayne is the namesake of the largest county in the state of Michigan, Wayne County. Those of us who live in Southeast Michigan, of course, are very familiar with that name and with the county. But he plays an integral role in the relationship between new Americans, settlers coming here, and the Indigenous people.
Yes, and the namesake of my alma mater, Wayne State University,
right?
Too. And also,
right.
he was considered a real tough guy in the mode of Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone way back. And a guy named Marion Morrison took his name to become John Wayne. That's John Wayne was adopted that name.
He's a namesake of Anthony Wayne. That's right.
Yeah. I've got two chapters on Anthony Wayne in the book. You know, Stephen, the biggest loss ever suffered by the United States military, this all ties into Wayne, mm-hmm. was the Battle of the Thousand Slain, it was called. It was Arthur St. Clair, who they named Lake St. Clair after. Mm-hmm. He led an expedition against the United Tribes of the Anishinaabeg, the Potawatomi, Ojibwe, Ottawa, the Miami people, and the Shawnee, and many other tribes. They were holding the line at the Ohio River. And Arthur St. Clair led an army up their way and got his ass kicked from here to next Sunday with more than 800 of his troops and camp followers killed off. And, you know, a lot of people think that Custer's Last Stand was the greatest battle ever fought by the Indians, but that's not true at all. The greatest battles ever fought by the Indians were right here in the Midwest and in Pennsylvania. Well, the upshot of this is that General George Washington designated Mad Anthony Wayne to come in and wipe out this alliance of Native peoples. And at that time, there was no United States Army. So this was, the Indians had destroyed one third of the military forces of the United States.
Wow.
That'd be like if we today, one third of the Air Force, Marines, Army, and Navy were destroyed. You know?
Wow.
So this was the biggest, proportionally the biggest defeat in American history. And Anthony Wayne, the native peoples called him the Black Snake because he crept along with his troops over a 2-year period into their territory in Ohio and Indiana, and he never slept. They could never get the drop on him. And he ended up defeating the native warriors at the Battle of Fallen Timbers, which is just a few miles south of Detroit, mm-hmm. you know, maybe, well, 70 miles. Definitely a good day trip for your listeners.
It's down around Monroe, isn't that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's Maumee. No,
or is it further
south of Monroe?
Okay.
Yeah. And anyway, this crushed this alliance of Indians, and it was the first major treaty in which they were forced into a small area in northwestern Ohio, the mighty Shawnee tribe was once one of the biggest tribes in America, and the Miami people. And eventually they too, even on this small area they were granted, they were forced at gunpoint west of the Mississippi
mm-hmm.
to what was then called Indian country, meaning the bleak reservations of the Kansas and Great Plains.
Yeah. So, go ahead.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Today we have steamrolled all of these Confederate monuments and namesakes and all that, but we still honor Anthony Wayne. Hamtramck was one of his generals. Arthur St. Clair with place names. And we forget that these guys did search and destroy missions against against thousands of Native peoples live here. Mm-hmm. You know, because after they, after Wayne had crushed the Indians at the Battle of Fallen Timbers, well, he set about burning their orchards, burning their villages, burning their crops. You know, then they would take hostages of women and children as bargaining chips against any remaining warriors. So it wasn't, you know, I mean, these people are still honored in their place names throughout, mm-hmm. you know, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Sure, sure.
Everywhere, you know.
Yeah. So let's mm-hmm. talk about these negotiations between mm-hmm. The indigenous cultures and the settlers.
Yes.
Why would the indigenous Americans even bother negotiating with the British? I mean, what was the motivation?
Excellent question, Stephen. And there's a very simple answer. When the Native peoples first met the French in the early 1600s, they were astounded and very pleased to receive these technological advancements, metal pots and pans, iron axes, steel knives, muskets, manufactured clothing. This made their lives so much easier. Mm. And they were just amused that all the French wanted was, you know, beaver skins, which were all over the place. You know, there were 600 million beaver in North America when the French arrived. Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, these traders egged the Indians on to hunt the beaver and other species, fur-bearing species, to extinction. And then, by that time, a lot of Native peoples had lost the survival skills they once had, or had no desire to return to them, any more than any of us would desire to return to plowing field with oxen for subsistence mm-hmm. farming. Mm-hmm. So what the Native peoples had, what nothing left to trade, was their land. And they were usually under the gun to trade it too. And a lot of them had married into these traders had married into their families. And so they egged them on to make these treaties too. Mm. So basically, it was these colossal debts to traders that were a big part of why the Native people sold their land.
Yeah.
Now, add to that, the concept of buying land initially or selling land was completely unknown to them. If I were to ask you if I could buy the sun or the wind or the clouds, you might say, well, what could it hurt? Right. And and so that was their perspective, too. They had no idea what selling land would mean. The land was a commons, and they had no idea that there were 7 million people on the Atlantic seaboard who were just dying to get a piece of it.
Right.
And what it meant to sell their land.
Yeah. That was our conversation with journalist Robert Downs about the history of land here in the state of Michigan and its connection to Native Americans who were forced to give up that land so that Michigan could exist. That conversation aired on August 21st. Carrie, this was a different week for us here on Created Equal, a themed week, as I said earlier. I kind of like this approach. We're going to do this again.
Yeah, I mean, When the conversations align in this way, I think it makes sense. It worked out for us. But I again say I like the fact that we can touch on these mm-hmm. conversations. It's stuff that we run into every single day and don't often think about.
I love the idea of getting people to stop for a second and think about things that we just kind of walk past in our lives every day. That's it for Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes at WDET.org. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.